Are you someone who uses cannabis as part of your lifestyle? If so, I wonder if this resonates with you. You want to enjoy a mellow unwind with some cannabis, but you can't stand that your high is constantly being tainted by physical discomfort from binge eating. You swear this will finally be the night that you don't eat out of control. But once you have the savory snack, you have to go for sweet, then back to savory, and so it goes until the next thing you know, your stomach feels real funky from a mix of lots of different foods. If you wish that there is a way to enjoy the experience of using cannabis without the unwanted side effects of out-of-control eating, you will not want to miss the Cannabis and Intuitive Eating Workshop. On Thursday, April 18th at 3 p.m. Pacific, I'm hosting a workshop to teach you exactly how to navigate intuitive eating while under the influence of cannabis. Get $15 off when you use code PODCAST at checkout. Head to the link in the show notes to learn more and enroll.
I was working out, and working at shoving in food.
Welcome to Shoulders Down, a podcast about intuitive eating and living. I'm your host, Leah Kern, and I'm an anti-diet dietitian and certified intuitive eating counselor. In this podcast, you will learn to harness your body's innate wisdom to govern not just how you eat, but also how you live. It is my mission to help you heal your relationship with food and body so you can live your most aligned and fulfilling life. Welcome, and I'm so glad that you're here. Hello, and welcome back to Shoulders Down. This week we have a really fun, unconventional episode. I'll give you the backstory for how this episode came to be, but first I'll just share that my partner, my boyfriend Al, he goes by Al, his name is Alex, is on the episode today. And some backstory for how this came to be. So the first thing I'll share is that I have a platform on social media, and I have been pretty deliberate from the start of just about like being aware of the amount of my personal life that I share on there. It feels really important to me to always ask myself, like, is this content, is this thing that I'm sharing actually going to help the person who is struggling with their relationship with food, the members of this community, the listeners, the followers on Instagram, whatever it is, the newsletter subscribers. So I always try to be mindful about that. And as a result, I mean, I don't share so much of my personal life unless I feel it can be a helpful teaching moment or related to intuitive eating, body image, those kind of things. So a few weeks ago, a client of mine DM'd me on Instagram. I shared something related to food. I think it was related to cinnamon rolls, and it included something about like my partner making cinnamon rolls, whatever. And I posted that on my stories, and she replied to it and said, I would love to hear him on the podcast. And I was like, okay, what would you want? You know, pitch me the episode. Like, what would it be? And she was like, here's a bunch of questions that I feel like would be helpful to hear about. And then I pulled the Instagram people, and turns out people had a lot of really great questions related to navigating intuitive eating in a relationship and, you know, dealing with like, what if your partner is not an intuitive eater? What if they say harmful diet comments, like all of these pieces. And I thought on it and I felt, you know what, this actually would be interesting. So all of that to say, today, Alex/Al, I pretty much solely call him Al, is on the podcast. And I ask him a lot of the questions that the audience asked, in addition to some of my own. And I can't wait for you to hear it. It's really fun and quite honestly, a little vulnerable for me to share this part of my personal life here, but it feels right. I have to say, like, sometimes I find on Instagram, it feels to me like people use like parts of their personal life almost as like bait to get engagement. And that's always felt kind of like icky and inauthentic to me to do that. And so that's why I always do ask myself the question of like, is this going to help the person who's following me for healing their relationship with food? And in the case of this today, these questions, this episode, I absolutely feel like there's some gold in here. There's some helpful nuggets, and I can't wait to share with you. I hope you enjoy. Oh, should I give you any background on our relationship? Is there anything you need to know? I guess it would be helpful to know that we've been dating for like a year and a half. And yeah, I think that that's probably important backstory because he talks about how his relationship with food changed and what he learned about himself through learning about intuitive eating. And so just to give you that timeline, it's been like a year and a half, I think. Is that true? Let me like take a moment to count. Hang on. Okay. Yeah, that's true. So besides that, there you have it. That's the backstory. I hope you enjoy this very casual episode. By the way, we are like sitting on the couch chatting for the hour. And if the audio sounds a little funny, that's why. It's also like, you know, you hear the New York City streets in the background. And it's just a very casual episode. So you feel that in the conversation and you also hear that in the audio quality. So apologies for that up front. I hope you enjoy. But before diving into the interview with Al, we are going to first answer a listener question. Okay, so today's listener question comes from a listener named Daniel, and he says, "Hey Leah, I love your podcast. You provide a much needed voice in the anti-diet community. The content is unique, relevant, and engaging. Thanks for all you do. I've looked into strategies to addressing binge eating, and there seems to be two schools of thought. The first is intuitive eating. The second is a variant of acceptance and commitment therapy that is grounded in 1, humans evolved with higher and lower brain structures. 2, the lower brain structures want to eat all the things all the time. 3, so just tell your lower brain no and stop binge eating. This is a simplification, of course, but not by much. If I accept that my brain's biological evolution is still stuck in the hunter and gatherer era and has not kept pace with cultural evolution, agriculture, supermarkets, fast food, etc., how does intuitive eating fit in? Is the acceptance commitment therapy approach better suited to some people and intuitive eating better for others? Many thanks." Okay, Daniel, this is an amazing question. I really love talking about evolutionary psychology and how that impacts the way that we interact with food in our environment today. So I'm really excited to dive into this one. Before diving in, I'll just give the disclaimer that I always like to give, which is that all content in this podcast is for informational and educational purposes only. The information and education provided is not intended or implied to supplement or replace professional medical treatment, advice, and or diagnoses. I'm only one person with one lived experience as well. So I encourage you to seek out insights from folks with other lived experiences, as well as consulting your own inner wisdom. So the way you have this question framed, Daniel, is very much like either or, right? It's either intuitive eating is the answer to solving binge eating, or acceptance and commitment therapy grounded in the fact that human evolution, it has not yet caught up, our brain wiring hasn't yet caught up with our current environment. And I would definitely challenge you to open up your way of looking at this, and instead of seeing it as either or, considering that both of these frameworks can be helpful tools in your toolbox of healing binge eating. So let me explain a little bit more what I mean by that. The first thing is that I use this education around our evolutionary history with my clients all the time. It comes up all the time because in the grand scheme of evolution, our current environment of, you know, having supermarkets and not having to spend all of our time and energy hunting and gathering and building shelter and acquiring water, that's a relatively new thing in the grand scheme of human evolution. So it is important to bring this up because our wiring, our brain pathways haven't yet caught up. They haven't yet evolve to where we are today. So this is absolutely important. It is relevant. However, this mere fact of like, yeah, human evolution, our wiring hasn't caught up with our current environment, accepting and committing to this piece of information, in my view, is not going to ever solve someone's binge eating alone. That is because simply accepting this fact still doesn't address the fact that like you feel out of control around food and that, you know, you have all of these probably diet thoughts floating around in your brain and all these rules and restrictions. It doesn't help deal with all of that residual gunk that is floating in your brain as a result of existing in this current world in diet culture. So that's the problem. There's a huge gap with this acceptance and commitment therapy model of like, okay, I've accepted that. It's something absolutely to look at and to consider. But now what? Like, how do I now get from this place of feeling obsessed and out of control around food to feeling peace? Like, the acceptance and commitment model, there's no tools there. There's no structure really to help you move forward. Interestingly, and very much importantly, intuitive eating bakes in this concept that we are hardwired for survival. We are hardwired to get our needs met, to think about food. Intuitive eating has this concept baked into it. So let me explain what I mean by this. Intuitive eating is a framework with 10 principles that are used to work to heal the relationship with food. The second principle of intuitive eating is honor your hunger. So dieting, when you live in the diet mindset, you very much don't honor your hunger. You might feel, oh, I'm hungry, but you know, don't have enough calories left in my calorie tracking app, don't have enough points left to eat anything else, or the clock isn't saying the right time for my fasting window to end or whatever. So there are endless factors that interfere with your ability to simply honor your hunger. Now, when you are not consistently honoring your hunger, your brain is like, uh-oh, our survival is being threatened. Food is not always available when we need it. Therefore, we need to amp up thoughts about foods, cravings for foods, specifically cravings for energy dense foods, which are considered quote unquote like junk foods by diet culture, which is why we see, you know, often binging on those more calorie dense foods is very common. And so your brain will do everything possible because of that old evolutionary wiring to get you to get food and get those needs met. Now, when we work to unlearn all of these rules and diet mentalities and beliefs about good food and bad food, that is when we can start to show our brain, hey, look, food's available. We don't have to think about food all the time and binge on calorically dense foods any chance we get, because when we get hungry, we can eat. We have access to food. It's not restricted. And so this is a way that intuitive eating is very much considering this old evolutionary pathway and our wiring. Acceptance and commitment therapy of like, yes, we are hardwired to survive, to seek out calorie dense foods. An important piece here is that was in the context, that wiring was in the context of restriction. Back when we were hunter-gatherers, food was restricted because we didn't have grocery stores on every corner. And so our brains were always like, okay, you know, any chance we get, we need to stock up on food, gorge ourselves at this, you know, berry bush or whatever we came across in our less evolved times. And so that's what we would do. We would probably go long stretches without eating as much and then gorge ourselves. And that was because our brain was like, we need to get this all in now while we can, because another period of, you know, restriction or, you know, starvation as the body understands it could be around the corner at any time. So when we have food rules, when we say you can only eat whole foods or you can only eat, you know, no carbs, keto, paleo, Whole30, gluten-free, whatever form of dieting you have or diet mindset you have fell victim to, when we do that, our brain registers, oh shit, food is restricted. Even if you have a full pantry full of food and a grocery store around every corner, because you have made so many foods off limits and you've created so many rules and restrictions around what you can and cannot eat, your brain registers that as we are being restricted, therefore our survival is being threatened. So all of that to say, how can you heal your relationship with food? Well, you can work to unlearn these food rules and help your brain see that no food is restricted. And when no food is restricted, of course, obviously not in the case of a medical or religious reason, I'm talking about self-imposed restrictions in the name of trying to manipulate your diet or trying to, like, quote unquote, be healthier. When you lift all of these restrictions, your brain comes to see and understand and internalize that we don't have to gorge ourselves anytime we're given the chance, because these things are always allowed and we have enough access. We have enough food around. And I want to name here the importance of food insecurity causing these similar outcomes of feeling out of control around food, because food is very literally scarce in the case of food insecurity. We have an episode coming up in a few weeks about food insecurity and intuitive eating. So I just want to name that I'm so aware of the privilege that comes with intuitive eating. And within talking about this topic, it feels important to just name that. So to summarize, the acceptance and commitment therapy model is based off of our evolutionary wiring that said we need to seek out food every time we get the chance. we are hardwired to seek out food. However, the piece that is so important to see is that that wiring evolved in a time when food was scarce. So the food being scarce is what triggers those pathways. Food is scarce. Okay. We need to gorge ourselves now because we need to protect our survival. Nowadays, what we have and what we see a lot with people struggling with their relationship with food are people who have all of the access in the world. They have the means of acquiring food. They have the access to the food. Except as far as their brains are concerned, food is scarce again, just like it was in those hunter-gatherer days, because of all of the internalized rules and restrictions around the food. The body triggers those pathways and is like, oh, gotta, you know, amp up cravings, gotta eat every chance we get, because it believes that food is scarce. So, in my view, from my experience as an intuitive eating dietitian, the way to truly heal binge eating is to allow yourself permission, unconditional permission to eat the foods you crave, because then your brain will not register food rules, and food rules turns into food is scarce. Food is scarce turns into our survival is being threatened. Our survival is being threatened turns into we need to amp up thoughts about food, cravings for calorically dense foods. We need to amp up our drive to acquire those foods. Whew, I'm getting passionate. I'm like screaming over here at the mic. I hope this answers your question, Daniel. And there's a lot here, but at the end of the day, what I want you to walk away with is the knowing that yes, we have those old evolutionary pathways that we're still existing by. However, those pathways are triggered by scarcity, the same scarcity that existed back then. Now, assuming that, you know, you're in a position where you can acquire foods, your brain should be able to rest easy knowing we don't have to think about food all the time, obsess over food all the time, because hey, it's here whenever we want it, whenever we need it. And that is the key difference with how times used to be and how times are now. I hope this is helpful. Again, the food insecurity episode will be coming in probably like, I'm not going to give you an exact timeline because I don't know off the top of my head, but we have an episode coming up on food insecurity. So if the reason that you're feeling out of control as you're listening to this has more to do with food insecurity as opposed to food rules, then that's something I am planning to address and it is on my radar. Daniel, thank you again for this question. As you can tell, I got very passionate about it. I hope this answers your question. And if you have a question of your own that you would like to submit, the link to submit that question will be in the show notes. Now, finally, for the episode with Al.
Testing.
Right, it's a real thing. It's not a test. Okay. Welcome to the podcast, Al. We're so excited to have you here.
Oh my God, I'm so happy to be here.
It's very fun. The people wanted you on, so here we are.
It's such an honor. I really feel great to be here.
We're so happy to have you. We're going to start by asking about your relationship with food. What's your story with your relationship with food as much as you're comfortable getting into?
My story is perhaps different than your general podcast guest. I would say I've always had a good relationship with food. So I feel fortunate in that regard. You know, a lot of people don't. And that's something I've come to realize after being with you. So, you know, definitely I feel good about my relationship with food. When I was younger, I was allowed to eat whatever I wanted. So right off the get-go, it feels like, you know, that's a healthy way to do it. You know, learning what I've learned, I know it's a healthy way to do it, but just it feels like that's the right way to do it. And my parents had that approach. Actually, interestingly enough, my dad's mother was very strict about food.
I didn't know that.
You didn't know that?
Nana,
yeah. So Nana would make my dad sit and clear his plate.
Oh, okay. I did know that.
Yeah, she's like an old school, very old school Jewish woman. And she would make the weirdest dishes. He would tell these stories about how his mother would make, you know, cow's tongue for him and his friend would come over for dinner. And they all had to sit and clear their plate.
Besides having to clear your plate, did she have rules about what they were allowed to have and not have?
I don't think so. I think what you had to have was what was there. So that comes along with the clearing the plate issue. Mm-hmm. So you have to finish whatever Nana made. And if it wasn't attractive, then you had to eat it. I don't know off the top of my head if he wasn't allowed to have, like, cake, for example.
Yeah, okay.
So I think the way that affected my dad, he was unhappy about that. So he wanted different for his kids.
Yeah.
So we were allowed to have whatever we wanted. I mean, we didn't, like, if I asked for 10 bags of candy, that wouldn't be, you know, what we had in the house, obviously. But within reason, you know, I was allowed to have the fun cereals, you know, the one that's just cookies, for example. Yeah, so we had stuff like that. I remember, you know, being asked what I want from the grocery store. They were going to go shopping, you know, so that was really, you know, kind of free range. So for that reason, I always felt like I could eat whatever I wanted, and that was really healthy.
That's awesome. Yeah.
You know, like, there wasn't like a, oh, this is bad for you kind of stigma being placed on me as a kid.
Yeah, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I think from the parents parentally, there was no obstruction to my food journey at all. So that's really good, and I'm really fortunate for that. So I've always had a good relationship with food. When I got to college, it changed a little. For one, I had a friend when I was a sophomore who was a vegan, and she convinced me that meat is really bad for the environment, which I think is true to a certain extent. I mean, the hyper amount of, you know, steaks and stuff we eat, you know, in America in particular, like, we eat a ton of meat, and that, you know, has things that come with it, like, you know, methane from the cows, and you have also, you have just a general, like, increased water usage to produce, and it's not efficient, you know, you have to feed the food, basically. So, like, for these reasons, I decided to be vegetarian. So that was the first taste in my life of sort of, like, food restriction, mm-hmm. I guess you could say.
All from this one girl.
From this one girl. She was a good friend of mine. We were living in the same suite in college, so we spent a fair amount of time together.
It feels like classic college, like someone, like, just convincing you that they're a vegetarian and, like, you should, not directly probably saying you should do this too, but then suddenly you're like, well, I guess I'll do that. Like, it feels, it just feels very classic in a way, especially UVM with the environment.
Especially UVM. But in college, you're just an impressionable
sponge.
Yeah, sponge. You're at that stage in life. So, I mean, it hit me, the amount of water that goes into, like, producing a hamburger. Like, I was, you know, sort of affected by that. And I decided to give it a try. And I thought I felt better as well, you know, when I was not eating meat. So I sort of thought, like, I felt less tired, or, like, my stomach wasn't as, like, you know, like, sort of, like, choked up. And I felt like at the time when I was eating a lot of meat, maybe a little, like, constipated even. So for me, having changed my diet sort of felt like a way to make me feel better. And maybe it was just, you know, like, survey bias, or what's the word?
Placebo.
Placebo, yeah. So I don't really know, because I went vegetarian and then I didn't look back. So it's not like I went on and off and compared it. It was only that initial moment you have to mm-hmm. kind of, like, say, oh, I feel better. And then after that, you just believe you feel better.
Yeah. It's hard. So this happened sophomore year.
Sophomore year. So yeah. I was 19.
It's hard to say, because it's like, going vegetarian is not the only variable. Like, you are, have been out of the house. You adjusted to college 2 years. You have 2 more years. Stress impacts your stomach. So, like, maybe you really did feel better, but to say that being vegetarian is the sole reason you felt better, my guess would be that there was more going on, and we can talk about, like, all the way up until today. So you're vegetarian because some girl in college, sophomore year, tells you you should be mm-hmm. more careful about the environment. Mm-hmm. The guilt gets to you. You go vegetarian. And then what happens from there? How long does that last?
So, yeah, the guilt hit me, and I was like, you know what? I'm going to stand up and do something about this environmental issue. And I did feel good about that, for sure. And I still ate a lot of food. I guess at first it was sort of like, oh, I don't feel entirely satisfied. So sometimes you find yourself eating, like, a lot of bread. Mm-hmm. As a vegetarian, you have to learn how to eat things like beans and sort of, like, dark grains, like farro, brown rice. That kind of stuff provides, like, a certain, like, satisfaction mm-hmm. above and beyond, like, just the carby stuff that
fiber, protein.
Yeah, I mean, you're looking for, like, umami. You know, you're sort of missing that. I mean, you can do tofu, you know, like, fake burgers also, you know, that kind of stuff can provide that umami. So, I mean, I started eating more narrowly, I guess. And so for a little while, maybe half a year, I had to kind of figure that out. And eventually I did. I remember when I told my parents that I was going vegetarian, they laughed at me and they were like, okay, well, we're not cooking for you specially. And also, they said, we'll see how long it lasts, mm-hmm. you know? And I remember that being like such a driving force for me to like continue.
Just prove them wrong.
Yeah. Cause yeah. I'm like, you know, screw you guys. So I did 6 years of vegetarianism. So it was the rest of college and a few years after, maybe about 3 years after I had my first bite of meat. I remember I was at Peter Luger's steakhouse. Yeah, it was my brother's birthday, and we, you know, got the steak for four or whatever. Yeah. I ordered a salmon that night, but the steak for four was on the table. It was Peter Luger's, and I said, okay, let me try it. And it was delicious. I had about two bites, though, and I started to feel a little queasy. So I thought to myself, okay, this is delicious. Like, how could it be such an awful thing to have it, you know, once every 6 years? Or maybe once every year or every couple months. So I sort of moved to this stage in my life where it was like, I don't eat meat a lot, mm-hmm. but I have it, you know, periodically. And I was allowing myself to have it maybe like once every other month. Mm-hmm. And that felt really good. Like I was missing it. The meat tastes great, you know, missing it in my diet. You know, it feels good to eat protein, heavy protein like that. So, you know, I started to eat meat a little bit more until kind of eventually I realized it wasn't the most productive thing in my life to try and like restrict that. And I just started eating meat again full time. I actually went on a trip to Europe, and that was kind of what blew the door open. And, you know, you realize in Europe, like, everything has meat in it. I remember in Italy, I just distinctly remember being at this one place, and there wasn't a single menu or item on the menu that didn't have meat. Mm-hmm. So after that, I was like, wow, this is how they're living over here. And, like, it seemed to me that people didn't have such scruples about what they were eating mm-hmm. and how to eat it and how yeah. much. They were just living free. And that really inspired me as well.
There's research about how Americans have the highest concern about their health, but the worst health. And I forget the countries exactly, but there's certainly some European countries that have the lowest concern about health and the best health. And they just eat wow. to enjoy.
Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, they just eat to enjoy. And
we have the highest concern, but the worst health.
Yeah. I
guess the question is, did the high concern cause a worse health? Or is it that we had such bad health that it raised our concern?
The one that seems more likely is the first one, that like we're high concern with the stress impacts our body, impacts also like us to restrict, which can lead to binging, which can lead to poor health outcomes. Whereas, mm-hmm. like, if you don't restrict in the first place and you just enjoy, you have more pleasure, less stress, and less, like, backlash mm-hmm. binging. So there's, like, a lot of factors.
Could also be in America, like, we're living more stressed. Mm-hmm. You know, maybe, like, the status quo about, you know, productivity or making money or, like, yeah. corporate jobs and the kind of the environment that kind of produces a sort of, like, stomach ulcer.
Yeah. You know? Absolutely. You also said in Italy they took a long time to eat. Like, you sat many hours. And that's something we don't do here. We rush.
Yeah, yeah. I think about it. For me, at lunch, like, I will just jam the food down my throat and keep going. But in Italy, you know, and I do construction. So in Italy, I was watching all the construction guys. And it's funny. The construction guys in Italy, like, it's a big force over there. They do a lot of construction, and there are a lot of craftsmen there. And I remember we were in Venice, and there's these guys were working on these, you know, 1,000-year-old buildings with a lot of care. And it's obviously a prestigious job in a way. And they're taking like 2 hours lunch break. Mm-hmm. I'm like, are they getting anything done? Probably, yeah. You know, I think they stay at work for longer. You know, they might work until 5, 6 p.m.
And probably feel more rested after a 2-hour break and a nice meal.
Definitely. I mean, they were just hanging out in the restaurant drinking wine. I mean, it was hilarious in a way. It was such a different, like, it's a real culture shock.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were in Italy, you're in Europe, and you decide that's really like the tipping point for just going full blown, no rules. You're not mm-hmm. a vegetarian. What do you feel like allowed you to do that? Because it sounds like for a while there was guilt around meat, and then even still like this level of restriction around like, well, once every few months, mm-hmm. what allowed you to be in this place where you're able to just say like, from now on, like, I don't want to restrict anymore?
Well, for one, it had been trending in that direction mm-hmm. since I started eating meat. Like, when I first had that first bite at Peter Luger's, I said, okay, I'm going to do this very infrequently, maybe once a year. And then, you know, half a year later, I have another bite. 3 months later, I have another bite. And all of a sudden, I'm doing it like once a month, once every other month, maybe every 6 weeks, I'll have some meat. You know, usually would be when I go out, or like if I buy, like maybe as a treat, I could buy like a nice steak, you know, and cook it myself, which is a pleasure.
As a treat.
As a treat. And really, I was trending in that direction, and I met you, and we kind of went from there, sort of like you brought my awareness to what it means to restrict food, which I didn't know about so much.
Yeah.
Because, I don't know. I mean, it's just not a big part of what was talked about in my family or amongst my friends so much.
Yeah. But,
so I was introduced to this concept of restrict and binge. And bigger than that, really, just kind of like what it means to be an intuitive eater, sort of like allowing yourself the opportunity to have whatever you like. And yeah. I realized I've been craving meat more, especially, you know, because I like to work out. I'm in the gym. You know, you need protein, whatever, you know, that's what the guys are all saying. So like, you want to eat some protein, you know, and as a vegetarian, it feels a little bit harder. I mean, you take the protein shakes, but it's not the same level of satisfaction. Like, it's not satisfying to choke down a protein shake. Like, right. I don't feel like I ate protein.
Right.
So, you know, I realized, I guess I was kind of like stoppering my desire for a little while. And, you know, really meeting you, I started to eat more and more. And then I went to Italy, and then that really kind of just blew the doors off it. And just since then, I've just been, you know, more free.
So to the point about that, those moments when you would have a bite of meat when you were still considering yourself vegetarian, and then kind of get in your head about like, wait, I think I feel bad now. I got queasy. Like, I need to stop. At this point, how does meat feel in your body? And with hindsight, does it feel like those moments were not to like diminish and say like in your head, but more kind of like psychological versus a, you know, a physical experience?
That's a great question. It's tough to say. I do know that at that period in my life, so I had IBS when I was 13. I was like pseudo-diagnosed. I mean, I guess you can say that it's a real thing, but it's also in your head to a certain extent, IBS.
Well, there's a big connection with the brain and your mental state, anxiety, all those things. So.
Yeah, it wasn't like a chemical, like they didn't test for something in my bloodstream and say, this proves you have IBS.
Yeah.
But I remember I was 13, and I was very painfully like constipated and bloated, and I had trouble with like regular bowel movements. And I was seeing a couple of doctors and trying some like elimination diets.
Yeah.
And we sort of landed that I have IBS, and like certain foods need to be controlled.
Yeah.
You know, like they told me no coffee, no chocolate, no caffeine. They told me avoid spicy, avoid greasy. They told me no ice cream. They told me don't put ice in my water. And I mean, well, I'm 13. This is ridiculous to ask that I do these things.
Yeah.
But I sort of took to heart, like, okay, some things make me feel better than other things, and other things make me feel bad, and I should try and pay attention to that. And I guess I zeroed in on that as meat as being one of those things.
Right, right. So that brings us to today, your relationship with food today, which also brings us to our relationship, which is the thing that people have questions about. So a few weeks ago, I polled the people on Instagram, and a lot of these questions, all of these questions, actually, most of them are from questions that the people have. What were you going to say?
I'd say it feels really, I feel like such a place of honor to be having the people asking questions about me. Like, I don't do intuitive eating, like as a lifestyle, I guess I do it, but it's not like a job for me. So
the people have questions. They're curious.
Okay.
Okay. So this is where we're going to start to kind of assess your understanding of intuitive eating.
As okay. Jesus.
No, a little bit of a test. Okay. Say you are out in the world and someone's like, what, you know, somehow it comes up and you start talking about, oh, my girlfriend's a dietitian, and they're like, oh, like maybe she can tell me what to eat or help me lose a few pounds. What do you say? How do you, and then how do you explain, like, say it's a situation where they want to hear, they're not like shutting you down. How do you describe intuitive eating? Like, what's your, like, I call it your intuitive eating elevator pitch.
Okay. It's funny question because it really does happen. Like, a lot. It's like so much so that like I'm almost like on guard when I say what you do, you know, because everybody has something to say about food.
Yeah. Well, now everybody, I know how it feels to be me. I'm on guard when I say what I do.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, you chose that though. You know, yeah. I got drafted.
You did. Okay. So we're going to play it. We're going to role play the situation. Oh, your girlfriend's a dietitian?
Yeah. Well, she's a dietitian, but she's a special dietitian who doesn't believe in diets. I would say an anti-diet dietitian.
So there's just like no rules? Like, how is that going to work?
It's not going to work in a conventional sense if you try and hold yourself to what you've learned already. But if you're willing to open your mind to it, the basic principle is that when you try and edit your feeding, you dissociate from your body's ability to tell you what it needs. Mm-hmm. So when you look at, you know, a pile of greens, and you just had a pile of greens for breakfast, it might not be appetizing at lunchtime. So she would say, for lunch, you can have a burger and fries. You know, you had a nice bowl of greens for breakfast. You know, you can have whatever you want. If that's what you're craving, you can have whatever you want.
But what if, wouldn't I just always eat a burger and fries then? I don't think I'd ever crave greens then.
Well, she would say, go ahead and try it. You know, have a burger and fries 3 meals a day and see how you feel. Probably you're going to be sick after 2 days of that. You're going to be viscerally sick and you're going to want some greens or anything else. Fruit, yogurt, bread, you know, could be anything. But, you know, if you just, you want variety in your diet, and that's the way humans came up. So she would say that, you know, you do whatever your body tells you to do.
Interesting. So why do I always feel like I'm craving cookies and candy and ice cream right now? Why do you think that is?
Well, you know, when was the last time you had that stuff?
I try not to have it because I don't want to be bad.
Well, I don't think you can be bad by eating or not eating. I don't think that is the point. I think what she would say is food doesn't have morality. There's no good or bad. And you can have cookies if you want. So have them once a day and see how you feel. Probably you won't want cookies every day.
So probably the reason that I want them so bad right now is because they're always restricted.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. That was really helpful. Can I follow her on Instagram?
Yeah.
That was amazing, Al. You
at Leah Kern RD.
Okay, great.
On Instagram.
Great, great. Okay. I'll look her up. I really appreciate it. You just changed my life, sir. Amazing. I love to hear your analysis of it, because I'm obviously talking about it all the time, so it's interesting to me to hear like what you've absorbed and how you reflect it back.
Mm-hmm.
I love it.
I'm also secretly hoping that I passed the test.
You passed the test.
That I've absorbed sufficient knowledge.
You have passed the test. You absorbed sufficient knowledge. There's one moment where you walked it back, but it was something like, no, I'm going to give you a little feedback. It was something like, well, like if you have greens for breakfast, then you can have a burger for lunch. But then you said, like, you can have whatever you want, whenever you want. And I just want to be really clear to the people. You can have a burger for lunch even if you didn't have greens for breakfast. It's not like you have to, like, cancel it out. You know, it's something.
Oh, okay, yeah.
But I know you didn't mean that.
You get what I meant.
Yeah, I know
you can
what
have
you
whatever
meant.
You want. Exactly.
You can have whatever you want. You did
well,
great.
Well, that's the point.
That's the point.
I actually, you know, I get people who bring that stuff up all the time. And they're generally shocked when I explain it to them. And I don't always feel like I have the credentials to sway them. So, you know, I might speak about it a little and try to change the subject.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think you find that a lot of people just don't believe you.
Yeah, of course. I mean, I have technically the credentials to sway someone, and still many people are committed to misunderstanding you because mm-hmm. they're what we call diet champions, where
diet
they're like,
champions.
I'm just, this is just my lifestyle. Like they just keep doubling down. And it doesn't matter that I'm a dietitian or I'm a certified intuitive eating counselor. They don't care because it's so much deeper than just, like, they don't believe you. Often it's that, like, it's become a mesh in their identity that, like, I'm a dieter.
Yeah.
That
yeah.
Starting to say, like, actually it doesn't work is very much threatening to someone's, like, ego or their identity.
When people feel threatened ego's identities, that's when I back off and change the subject.
Yeah, of course. And same. And especially with this stuff, it's not worth your energy at
yeah,
all.
Yeah.
And so would you say when you, in the times where, you know, naturally you meet someone, you start talking, if it comes up that you have a partner, like, what do they do is a pretty natural question. So
yeah.
For the times that this happens, do you feel like more often than not people seem open to intuitive eating, or more often than not they, like, from using your, like, emotional intelligence, they seem like, yeah, that's kind of bogus?
It feels like more often than not they are, but I can't say that that's the way people are, because, you know, I'm it's a biased survey. I only meet the people I meet.
True.
You know, not everybody in the world. It's a good mix, though. Maybe 70-30. Like, most people are, like, well, some people are, like, shocked and happy to hear it. Mm-hmm. Some people are more just, like, shocked and indifferent. And mm-hmm. then some people are, like, you know, like you said, diet champions. So you're going to have a range.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay. So this was a big one that people really wanted to know. Are you an intuitive eater? And would you say you were an intuitive eater fully before meeting me?
Mm. Yeah, I would say I'm an intuitive eater. I would say I was an intuitive eater beforehand, though. The question of fully, I mean, for one, I didn't know what it was. So, like, I didn't fully understand what that means. When I met you, it kind of came to me that although I allow myself to eat whatever I like, I did have some food rules. Mm-hmm. So, in essence, I would say I fully know. I would say I ate intuitively, but was not a completely intuitive eater because I allowed myself certain rules.
Right.
So I was in the gym like heavily when I first met you. So that one thing that actually we discussed, I want to say like our third date maybe, was, you know, like calorie counting mm-hmm. in a way.
Wait, which is just so interesting because it's reverse how most of my clients, not all of my clients and the people in this community, they think mm-hmm. of calorie counting, they think of cutting calories, and
right.
you're talking, in your experience, it was trying to hit a certain number
yeah.
in order to, like, bulk up, which ultimately has the same effect of being an outside cue that, mm-hmm. you know, if you're full, but you're like, ah, oh, shit, I got a few hundred more to make today's limit, today's goal, then ultimately that's a moment of you having to go against your body's cue for an outside metric.
Completely. So I was doing that, and that's not intuitive eating. So in a sense, I was not an intuitive eater, you know, completely. I was looking to ingest about 20 calories a day. I think that was the number I was looking for, or more if I could stomach it. The reason was, you know, I'm lifting weights 6 times a week and I want to gain weight, you mm-hmm. know, gain mass, gain muscle, look bigger. I think it's just a funny thing about society, like, especially American society, really where we are now and some of the problems that we face in regards to food, eating, diet, and body image. Because as a boy, I mean, at least in my experience, you know, you sort of, you want to be bigger, you want to be stronger, you know, taller if you can get it. Obviously, you can't, you know, genetics is you know, the limiting factor there. But so for me, I was trying to get big, you know, for my own reasons, not necessarily just to find a partner. But, you know, I've been doing the research, following certain forums and stuff and just kind of figuring out, well, what's working for other people. And people are saying they're getting really strong. They're eating this amount. And so that's what I was doing. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, I was gaining weight. I was gaining muscle.
Yeah.
So you can't say like, oh, well, like, you know, anti-intuitive eaters might say like, well, you know, that does really work. And their intuitive eating response to that, at least the response you gave me, was, you know, how does it make you feel?
Yeah. Sort of. At what cost?
At like, what cost? So, yeah. And that's kind of the essence of intuitive eating as I see it, is like, you know, it's really more like body image stuff, I guess. But like, you be at peace with the body you have in a way, you know, you'll settle out at what's right for you and what's healthy for you. So for me, I was eating too much. When I stop eating, like, you know, rigidly, like I stop kind of trying to force in so much, I lost a little weight. And, you know, at first I was upset about that. But, you know, understanding it at a greater level, I realized that that's what's sustainable. And I was feeling bad. You know, I was working out, and working at shoving in food. Mm-hmm. And it was, like, exhausting. And, like, I wasn't, like, you know, using the bathroom at the right amounts. Like, things were uncomfortable. It was not sustainable.
Yeah. And you just hit on an important point there, which is, like, it at the cost of physically feeling uncomfortable, of having, like, proper digestion, social life, because it takes up so much of your time, in your case, having to eat so much, mm-hmm. work out so much. And so the cost, I mean, you know, you have autonomy. You can say, like, this is worth it to me. But it sounds like from what you're saying in your story, it was a moment of, like, no, like the cost is very high. And also the big piece about sustainability, like, is it sustainable to keep up that kind of rigidity? And that, you know, it's interesting because the problems, again, that like the clients I work with struggle with, as you know, is the exact opposite, which is, you know, restricting, over-exercising to try to, you know, burn calories, limit calories as much as possible, those kind of things. And you're on the other side of the spectrum of, like you said, trying to get big. But at the end of the day, the end result is the same, which is like...
The end result is trying to manipulate the shape of your body, exactly. Right? Which is not right.
Yeah, exactly. I'm not going to say it's not right. Like, you have body autonomy. If that's how you want to spend your life, that's, you know, I work with people who come to me and say, I don't want to spend my life like this anymore. And I need help, you know, getting out of this. So, you know, that's for you to decide. And it sounds like in your story, you decided, like,
well, and it's also like, you can get buff without killing yourself.
Yeah.
You know, if you want to get buff, but do it in a sustainable way, you know, work out the amount that feels comfortable and healthy, you know, to the point where you're feeling good about what you're doing and not like you're stressing or taxing yourself, and eat as much as you want to eat. You know, if you feel like you're working out a lot, you're going to be eating a lot.
Yeah. And that's the thing, is naturally when you're expending more, your body craves more. So you don't have to try to hit this arbitrary outside number that some dudes on Reddit gave you. No offense, Al. but like that, because your body will naturally crave more calories and more energy if you're expending more energy. Mm-hmm. So these things are the body is so smart. We don't have to like impose these outside rules for it to thrive. So I'm curious to hear your first impression of intuitive eating. Like, we're on one of our first dates. You ask what I do. I tell you I'm an intuitive eating dietitian, and I start explaining it. What do you remember what you first thought about that?
Yeah, I think it was this conversation about the amount of calories that I was ingesting. Actually, when we first had the real conversation, although I don't know, obviously it came up. That must have been our first date, I think. That conversation, because it must have came up like immediately. But I just remember thinking, oh yeah, that makes sense. Mm-hmm. Like, pretty simple, like, really, if you think about it, it's actually the most simple.
Yeah. As we got to know each other more and you got to know what I do more, you've shared that like it was surprising to you to learn really like how much people struggle with their relationship with food. Tell me a little bit more about that experience of kind of like having your eyes open to this very widespread issue of having a disordered relationship with food and body.
Well, for one, it's an issue I didn't struggle with growing up. So I am fortunate and blind to the issue.
Right.
So there's that. But then, I'm also a man, so men struggle with it, obviously, but I think statistically at a much lower rate. So, you know, like, not something my friends are talking about, right. Not something my friends necessarily have the issue with, or like maybe one or two of them, but like most of my friends, you know, it's a non-issue. When I look at it from like a hindsight perspective, I guess I can see, you know, amongst my female friends and, you know, especially people of the older generation. And, you know, I'm Jewish, you're Jewish. It's a pretty, you know, all the time, it's a very Jewish thing, you know, to talk about, you know, what you're eating and how much you should eat and
food.
Oh, you all look, the time. It's, you're either you look skinny or you're, you know, you got too much fat on you. So this, what's the middle range? You know, it's not like my parents or my grandparents were ever like saying these things to me, but like in these communities of, you know, Jews, you're gonna see it a lot. But looking back on it, I can see how that's problematic in the time. At the time, because, you know, I'm somebody in a, you know, like, smaller body. I'm not, like, having the kind of, like, issues that come with, you know, society's preconceived notions about that. So I'm not really going to have these things thrown in my face. So for me, meeting you, you kind of exposed me to the world in a different light, I guess. It's a very prevalent issue. Now that my eyes have been opened, I see it all the time. And I do whatever I can, you know, to put in my two cents whenever it's appropriate. You know, I'm not like a warrior for the cause. It's not my job. But like when I do have the opportunity to say something, I will. And I happen to see it all the time, you know, at least weekly.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Is there an example that of you that that you could share of seeing it that wouldn't like expose anyone in your personal life? Like maybe someone, maybe a diet comment you've heard or something you've seen or heard been said.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard I need to lose 10 pounds.
Yeah. Yeah.
And or such and such, summer's coming up.
Yeah.
Or, oh, I got a wedding, you know, I want to fit the dress.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I mean, it's countless and countless.
Right.
You know.
So pre kind of having your eyes open to this world, a comment like that, like, what would it have made you think, if anything, or would it have just been like nothing? And what does it make you think now?
Well, I think before it would not, it's not like I'd take that comment and be like, oh, yeah, you need to lose 10 pounds.
Right.
But I would just kind of like see through it and be like, well, like it's transparent. Like it doesn't hit me or I don't hit it back, you know?
Yeah.
But now I see like the deeper issue, like that person might be struggling.
Mm.
This might be something they think about a lot.
Yeah.
They might, you know, maybe if I can, you know, nowadays I might make a comment like somebody says, you know, and it's such a touchy thing because it's really like such a like almost taboo thing to kind of bring to people. Like it's tough to tell people about their body.
It's very, you know, personal. Yeah.
So if somebody comes to me and they're like, or I just overhear it, I'm in a conversation and somebody's like, I need to lose 10 pounds. And I might say, I think you look great as you are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you look beautiful right now. Or, well, I might say that to you, but I probably wouldn't say that to a random stranger.
You look beautiful.
But anyway, yeah, I mean, like, yeah, I mean, just try to say something a little bit. So, like, now I might see more, like, have empathy for something that I now realize is a problem. And,
yeah.
You know, not saying I can fix it because they have to fix themselves, but I might try and be helpful instead of harmful or indifferent.
Yeah, it's like kind of a signpost. If someone's saying, I need to lose 10 pounds, it sounds like before that was just like, okay, that person said that. And now it's like, okay, there could be something deeper going on here that's like a real struggle for this person in their world.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah, that makes a lot of sense as a reflection. It's interesting to hear you reflect on, because I don't know, it's fun for me. Like, I'm having fun right now. I really enjoy, like, this is like genuinely it's interesting so good to me. I want to hear about what surprised you most about learning about intuitive eating and or health at every size and or like the anti-diet world in general. Those are all just like under the same umbrella, really.
What surprised me most?
Or just something that surprised you in general.
One big thing that surprised me is that when I learned that weight has no indicator of health.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, that's probably the biggest one because that's not what I've been taught.
Yeah, you and the rest of the world.
Anybody's been taught.
Yeah.
Not like the type of person who's going to, you know, look at somebody in a large body and say, you know, you're unhealthy. But and there is a preconceived notion that they might not be in the best of health,
mm-hmm.
you know. Or because they're out of shape, that they're not in good health. They might not be, even be out of shape. But I'm just saying, you know, like, you know, I guess I go to the gym a lot. So you see something like that in the gym and you're like, oh, this person is trying to whip themselves into shape. And like, you think your first thought is like, good for them,
mm-hmm.
you know. But learning that what I know now, it's like not necessarily, it doesn't necessarily mean anything. So,
yeah. Meaning, like, yeah, a person can just be going to move their body because it feels good and not because they're necessarily, like, trying to lose weight. And mm-hmm. also moving your body has...
A person might be in shape.
Yeah. They also might... Yeah, exactly.
Already.
Yeah.
You know, but that's not what the preconceived notion is. So,
right.
Like, you sort of assume that they're out of shape, but that's not the case.
Right. Yeah. This probably is the most surprising thing to a lot of people learning right. about this world of right. weight is not an indicator of health. You could be in shape at any body size. You could be physiologically healthy. You're like, on a... your kind of cellular level in any body size or shape. And it makes sense that it, like, even before it wasn't something where you were like walking around thinking, oh, people in larger bodies are unhealthy, but it was just kind of more of like an assumption because mm-hmm. it's the weight bias in our culture is very subtle. It's baked into the medical system. It's all mm-hmm. kind of just like perfuses the way we think and act and speak. And it's sneaky. So the fact that wasn't something that like you necessarily even realize, and then now it's like, oh, okay, it just very much weight is not an indicator of health.
It's so baked into the system. Even if you look at, I mean, I know we've talked about it before, but like when you're growing up, at least in New York, you have this thing called the physical fitness test.
Yeah, everywhere. Not everywhere, but like in public school.
Is that nationally? I don't know. But
yeah, so basically, it's the presidential fitness. I think it's like nationally in public schools, but yeah.
So then everybody listening knows what
people know what it
about.
Is, yeah.
So, yeah, I mean, I remember being embarrassed about that, and other people were embarrassed about that. I mean, and I felt like a fit person then, and you know, I do now too, but probably I was more fit then. But even so, I was never a good mile run because I have asthma.
Yeah.
And, you know, I was a little embarrassed about that section of it and sort of feeling like, oh, people are going to see me as out of shape or whatever.
Yeah.
And now looking back, I can only imagine, you know, the kids who are a little bit bigger, like how they must have been feeling.
Absolutely. I mean, I can't tell you how many of my clients cite an example in gym class of being like
traumatized,
forced to forced to run the mile, forced to do sit-ups, pull-ups, push-ups. And like, that was their first moment of having this self-conscious feeling about, is my body right? Is my body wrong? Why can the other kids do it? It's just a natural comparison. Like, how did you start talking about gym class?
You asked me what was surprising.
Oh, yes. That.
And then I went on to say, you know, this about health at every size. And
yes. Love it. Okay. Beautiful. Okay. So people want to know, how do you feel about my line of work and my platform on social media, the podcast, etc.?
I feel great about your line of work, frankly. There's nothing wrong with it. There's everything right with it. You know, you're helping people get healthy in their mind and, you know, spend more energy on the things they love. So I love that about you.
Thank you, Al. That's very
really,
sweet.
Really a nice thing to, you know, be able to say that you do.
And you know, I just want to... Oh, sorry. I interrupted you complimenting me.
It's okay. No, no. What are you going to say?
I was going to mention to the people, like, an interesting part about the social media aspect is that Al doesn't have social media. So, like, when we met and I was like, oh, this is what I do. This, you know, obviously Instagram's a big part of it. It wasn't like you could go on Instagram and learn about me and learn about my work. You only learned about it through me telling you about it or like specifically showing you a piece of content because it wasn't like you could see. But he is a newsletter subscriber.
I have the newsletter and I open it every week and I listen to the podcast weekly. Yeah, I don't have social media. So how did I feel about the social media aspect? I mean, I saw it as your, you know, your avenue for connecting to people. So it makes sense. I mean, I don't feel like I have any resentment about that.
Yeah.
I'm happy that you're on there because that's how you're touching the world. And I think it's great.
Thank you.
Truly. I mean, I don't happen to follow you on it, but I love it when I do see your content, either you showing it to me or members of my family who follow you. And, you know, I love that they can follow you there and that people are tuning into you.
Thank you, Al. That's very sweet. What's your favorite kind of content?
My favorite kind of content?
Yeah, of mine.
I like the videos you do when you're eating and you're filming yourself eating.
Yeah, I did.
Number one, I like to watch you eat. But for two, you know, they're usually sort of like, you know, really good messages. Like you just put a good message or like a funny story that relates to a message while you're eating. And, you know, it's just fun.
You like the eating videos. I did know that.
Now the people know.
Now the people know. Good. Okay. What have you learned about yourself as a product of being exposed to the anti-diet and intuitive eating world?
What I learned about myself is that I'm very fortunate to not be touched by the issue, really. Mm-hmm. You know, not to say that I'm not touched at all, but not personally weighed down by it. You know, I'm fortunate. I grew up in a loving home where they fed me whatever I wanted and nobody shamed me for what I ate.
They fed you whatever you wanted.
They fed it to me. They fed it to me. Yeah, I mean, you know, I think that's the biggest thing. Like, really, I mean, I learned a lot about the issue. Having met you, and then, you know, you look at the world a little bit differently after that, something like that. I mean, it's a very eye-opening issue.
What about the element of, like, rules and, like, rigidity versus, like, freedom and openness to choose what feels right for you in the moment and to allow that self-compassion? What about, like, the element? Because I feel like, I mean, I always...
Well, that's a change, yeah. I have more freedom in a way, like I don't try and stuff food down my face anymore to try and get big. I mean, that's the big thing.
Yeah.
And then also, you know, the vegetarianism aspect. I mean, I was going that way anyway, but, you know, it accelerated that. I mean, those are changes, but
I guess it's not what you learned about
yourself. The question about learning about
yourself. Yeah, that makes sense. Yeah. I'm not going to prod. I'm like trying to like maybe, tell you what you know. I'll tell you what you learned about yourself.
Yeah. Why don't you answer the questions, you know?
No, I mean, I have to. Okay, so intuitive eating at the end of the day is a self-care framework that has a basis of self-compassion. Self-compassion mm-hmm. is foundational because you need to be able, like, open to saying, oh, I ate that thing that didn't feel good in my body. Like, instead of like, oh, fuck you, that's terrible. It's like, yeah, oh, yeah. What can we learn about this? Like, how can we use this information to inform what we do next time? And obviously you didn't like, you don't get like mad at yourself if you ate something that, cause you don't have rules about what's like quote unquote good or bad. But I don't know. I feel like that this is more kind of entering the world of intuitive living, of just like allowing yourself permission to have your needs met without guilt. Like, I want a nap right now, I'll have a nap. You know, I want to not work right now. He works for himself, so that's like a possibility. And like do this other thing, I'll do that.
Yeah.
Maybe this is me projecting because I want to believe that you've learned those things. But I do think there's a tie-in almost to like intuitive living, to what feels right in the moment versus this like rigidity of like you have to do all these things.
Yes, I would say you are more personally guilt-free than I am in terms of living this way, that way, doing what's good for you, quote-unquote. And, you know, learning that from you, coming from intuitive eating through the lens of intuitive eating, definitely that is something that has positively impacted my life. Since I've been with you, I've allowed myself to take more breaks. You know, I work hard and sometimes I feel guilty when I rest. And, you know, I think that's an American problem.
Yeah.
So I don't want to say that I'm the only one who has that problem.
Of course. I mean, I struggle with that too still, even if, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, so I guess you could say I learned about myself that sometimes I have these behaviors. So, you know, I try and, you know, loosen up more now than I used to.
You feel like even just like the language of like, or the noticing, putting the feeling to the experience of like guilty, like feeling guilty for certain things that like are really just like getting your needs met, and our society like makes us feel guilty for. I mean, this is kind of a departure from the food conversation. It's more like intuitive living and like those kind of things. I don't know. That's my observation. Obviously, I didn't know you so much pre-intuitive eating because as we met, it just kind of all blends together. But definitely, like, increased self-compassion and identifying how you're feeling and, like, how that letting that be acceptable and okay is something I've seen in you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's also kind of like it's a problem. I think a lot of men deal with as well, you know, like addressing feelings and not just a problem for men, obviously, but maybe more so than ladies. Mm-hmm. But yeah, addressing feelings, putting words to feelings and, you know, honoring your feelings as well.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good stuff for anyone to work on, I think.
Yeah. And just to be like really clear, what's the connection with intuitive eating is about honoring your body's cues for food and, you know, cravings, those kind of things. But it expands. It also becomes about being able to feel what emotion you're feeling, and then from there being able to get those needs met with like, oh, I'm feeling like, you know, just completely.
Well, if you're feeling lonely, find somebody to hang out with.
Yeah, that's a very simplified version, but yes, but like even having the language and the ability to introspect and reflect and say like, this is what I'm feeling. This is like, you know, how I can either like get that need met or just have the awareness as a start. Because when people live in diet mindset, they don't even know what they're feeling or what their needs are because there's so much. Obviously not all the time, this is a generalization, but often what I've seen with my clients, there's so much numbness to your body in general because of denying its natural cues around food ends up overflowing into denying its whispers about its needs. Intuitive eating is like almost like inseparable from intuitive living, getting your needs met. And also, I mean, this is, I'll stop because I'm going to go into a whole TED talk, but that answers the question. Thank you. Okay. Okay. This one's interesting. So the next two questions kind of go together. The first is, can you think of a time where there's maybe something that you would have said or a comment that you would make and then maybe realize like, oh, this could actually be harmful, or triggering to someone who struggles with their relationship with food or body?
I mean, I guess pretty much any comment about weight or size, like, well, one big thing is I think watching how you respond when people put themselves down, like, because you could say something like, I don't know, you could say something that kind of like affirms their own issues, you know, if you're not careful. I think a big one also is being careful with the compliments that you give. Maybe that's the answer to the question. Like, if you tell somebody, oh, you look great, like, you look really skinny. Mm-hmm. Like, or one thing you see a lot, and I don't want to say it's something that I used to do, I don't think so, but, you know, you see, especially amongst the older generation, be like, oh, you look like you lost weight. Mm-hmm. You know, you hear that. Like, wow, like, you know. And that's just implying that, although it's a compliment, you know, it's implying that it would not be okay if you had gained some.
Yes. Good job, Al. That's great. You're proud of that answer. But that's a great, I mean.
That's what comes to mind, I mean, for me.
That's amazing. I mean, I know it's a great answer because it's so many people see how could it possibly be bad to compliment someone on weight loss.
Yeah.
And there's a few things here. I mean, one, it's like the idea that weight loss is a good thing across the board is like upholding like really fat phobia and this idea that like there's a body hierarchy and thin bodies are more valid or more worthy mm-hmm. in our society than larger bodies, which isn't true because mm-hmm. what you're saying without saying it again, sorry, I'm going off on a TED talk. You answered the question beautifully, but for the people listening who maybe
love your TED talks.
Okay. Thank you for listening. Yeah. So then you're saying like it's not compliment worthy to, you know, be in a larger body. Mm-hmm. Praise only comes when you're shrinking. And on top of that, it's kind of this like covert insult of like you were less worthy before.
Well, yeah, like imagine you're in a room with five people and one of them just gained some weight.
That's a great answer. So
thank you.
You're doing great. If someone listening to this is struggling with a partner making comments about food and body, maybe they're not saying it directly to them, but maybe mm-hmm. they're like, maybe it's a way they're talking about other people in the world. And maybe this is a person who, like you, a few years ago was in the dark about intuitive eating, body, like inclusivity, all these pieces, mm-hmm. weight stigma in society. How might you? Because now we're like asking for advice from you as a partner to mm-hmm. who has this unique experience to someone else who maybe their partner is like they're needing support. How might you recommend speaking to their partner to help them like see the problems with these things?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm no relationship therapist. Mm-hmm. I mean, I guess that you really have to look at the person's level of experience. Mm-hmm. If you're somebody who is keying into intuitive eating now and your partner has no idea, I might just start by trying to educate them.
Yeah.
And see how they respond to that. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, if you're somebody who has good intentions but doesn't know the issue, you can say something that's offensive. And that's in a lot of different, you know, realms of life, you know, depending on the issue. It could be bigger than eating.
Yeah.
But if you have somebody who's sort of been aware of the issue and makes these comments anyway, it's kind of a different question about what you do.
Yeah.
You know? I mean, it's really kind of a question in terms of relationships, like how can you bring up an issue to your partner? You know, mm-hmm. I would say compassionately is the best way.
Yeah. It is more of a relationship issue.
It's a relationship question.
Relationship sure. question than a food question.
Well, that's fine. I mean, I'm happy to answer those too. I mean, it's in the realm of food, obviously, in that lens, but it is a relationship question. I mean, I would say have compassion for your partner if you really care about them.
Right.
And try to explain it to them why that's hurtful to you.
Yeah, like, so another question that someone asked, I mean, there's a few kind of in this category of, like, what's almost, like, a reasonable amount for you to expect for them to, like, get this right, and what's, like, you having to handle your own triggers, and maybe I can, like, jump in here, too, because it is, like, but I'm curious if you have thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know what's the right amount. Because I think I want to say that differs for everyone.
Mm-hmm.
I would say it comes down to what is your level of tolerance. If you are extremely bothered, you need to say something about
it.
Or else it's just going to make a problem in your relationship. If you are only mildly bothered, you might be able to get over it.
I love that. I love this. Like, there is no right amount to expect from them or to, like, get it right or to, like, not trigger you. It really just matters what feels right for you. What feels like they're doing this too much and I'm trying to educate them and this is still happening. Like, mm-hmm. it's very personal because... Mm-hmm. Someone might feel like this is too much. This isn't like the kind of person I want to be with. They continue to make these like weight-centric comments, but someone else might feel like, okay, I can work with this. And that comes down to using your own intuition of like, does this feel right? Or am I trying like to like force this person to like understand something that they don't seem open to even trying on?
If it's on a scale of 1 to 10, 10 being a dire issue for you and 1 being a non-issue, if you're at a 7 or 8, like, and it's a real big issue and your partner knows about it, you know, they understand intuitive eating, and let's say you've told them or mentioned subtly that this kind of comment is hurtful and they keep doing it, you probably got to find a new partner.
Yeah, I think a big take home here is like, if it feels like too much for you, and if it feels like too much harm is being done for you, then like that's your litmus test. Then that's your answer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, all easier said than done. And I definitely think there's a component here of like neither of us are relationship therapists. And that's definitely an expertise that I would recommend seeking out.
Yeah.
So someone else asked, they used I'm going to read the question in their words.
Okay.
How can you train your partner to talk about food in a way that doesn't trigger you? I just laugh at the word train. Like, it's like you're like a pet.
Yeah. Like we should consult, the psychology books on, conditioning or whatever. Yeah,
exactly.
Classical conditioning.
So say,
you give them a treat every hour, you know, if they do the right thing.
Exactly. Yeah. For every hour they don't make a diet comment. Someone who's just like maybe just learning about intuitive eating and now they're like trying to teach their partner about it.
Yeah, I mean, I certainly do not have the experience to be able to say what's the right way to train somebody or anything.
I mean, I could talk about like me, like, you know, I don't like the word train, but like training you in the sense of like.
You've trained me, yeah.
Yeah, I guess I would say my advice for this would be to bring it up in a timely manner. Like, try not to like let it linger too long, because then it can feel funny if like you've been harboring this information for a long time, and like that could make them feel like, you know, you've been having these thoughts, and maybe it could tarnish trust. So I mean, I could vulnerably bring up, I'm not going to say the exact comment, but there was a time early on, like maybe like 2 months into dating, where we were like in a group and you said something that like, it wasn't a big deal. Probably no one else noticed. But to me, it was just like, I mean, I guess I'll share it. If you feel uncomfortable, I'll edit this out. We were talking and you were like objectively describing a person, or maybe it was like a character in a movie or something. And it was objective. It was like the person was large. It was a large person. And then you said the person was large, comma, like X amount of pounds.
Mm.
Do you remember this?
Vaguely.
Okay. Well, probably like...
I do remember when you told me to be careful about mentioning poundage.
Yeah, poundage. Like, pretty much there's just no reason to ever say a number such because it's like, pounds. Then, you know, someone listening could feel like, oh my gosh, like the description of like this person being large and this is the weight number associated with being large. Does that mean I'm large? I'm this weight number.
Right. Right.
And so I remember having a moment just like early on of like, okay, I'm just gonna say this. Like, this
and
is
how
so...
did you train me in that instance?
I just told you as soon as I could. I didn't tell you in front of the large group because that could feel embarrassing. And
I also don't want to call attention to the issue if somebody who might have been offended could then be offended.
Right. It was probably the next day or maybe even that night. I was just like, hey, like earlier you said this thing and I know your intention was not to be hurtful. Here's how it could be hurtful. Mm-hmm. And you've never said anything since, so like about.
Well, I think that's a beautiful way to do it. If you want to train, quote unquote, which is kind of a hilarious word, your partner.
Yeah.
You know, reward the good behavior, and without, you know, making such a big fuss, you know, gently, you know, dissuade the bad behavior.
Yeah, or just bring their attention to it and help them see how it could be harmful.
That's what I mean.
Exactly. So, to sum that up, I would say, in terms of like training your partner, being empathetic to that, like they probably don't understand this is a problem, giving them credit, like I know this wasn't your intention, but when you say XYZ, it could make me feel or it can make other people feel XYZ. So to help them see how this could be hurtful.
Mm-hmm.
And I think a big piece is be as like timely about it as possible.
Yeah, I agree with that. If it bothers you, you should speak about it immediately. That's probably everything in a relationship too.
Right. Again, we're not relationship therapists, but that seems like pretty common knowledge. Okay, so someone asked this question for me. So
for you, Leah.
Yes, for me, Leah.
Okay.
I get to have the stage now.
Okay.
Okay. Someone said, how has intuitive eating positively affected my, I'm reading my own question, my romantic relationships? I guess being that, like, obviously the people in this community know I've struggled with my relationship with food historically. So it's a good question. And I would just say the answer is really that I wasn't exactly seeking out romantic relationships when I didn't have a healthy relationship with food, because it was taking up so much of my brain space that I couldn't even consider seeking out a partner because I felt so uncomfortable physically in my body. I felt so uncomfortable in my mind because I was just thinking, obsessing, stressing over food all the time, that I didn't even have the mental real estate to venture into the world of dating. Like, when I think about my own timeline with that, I really dated the first person in my life seriously sophomore year of college, like sophomore year in the spring. And I healed my relationship with food and learned about intuitive eating the summer between like freshman and sophomore year. So it actually like really checks out for me. Intuitive eating, how has it affected my romantic relationships? It opened the door for me to have romantic relationships.
That's a big one.
It's a huge one. Yeah. And so I've never really been in a relationship not as an intuitive eater. But I would say, like, if I think about our relationship, and like such a huge part of our relationship is enjoying cooking and eating, and just like trying new foods. I mean, we live in New York City. There's a billion things to try. And I really feel like that would it would really tarnish our relationship if I was silently suffering, or not silently suffering, you know, feeling guilty about the food we were eating and feeling like this isn't a date I want to go on because it's too stressful. Or, I mean, when exercise used to be more of a stringent part of my life, when I struggled with my relationship with food and body, it could really ruin the ability to just like have like a spontaneous day, because you have to go like exercise in order to feel like mentally like valid for the day or whatever, quote unquote, earn your calories. So I'd say flexibility, openness, like spontaneity, and also connection, being able to connect over food without that like undercurrent of shame.
That's such a big one for us. We like to eat. We like to go out to eat. We like to cook. I like to take you on dates. And if I couldn't, it'd make me a little sad, you know?
And also, like, if I was, like, hangry all the time, you know, like, I think about...
If you're constantly starving, you're probably not in a great frame of mind for a date.
Totally. It's harder to connect. Or if you, like, do the thing where people, a lot of my clients struggle with this, a lot of people in this community struggle with like saving up calories for like a meal out, and then you go out and it's like, oh my god, like either you're like trying not to eat too much, but like you're in that primal hunger mode, that could ruin your ability to really connect and be present, because you're just like, your brain is just fixated on the food if you've deprived it.
If you're starving, you sit down to eat, you know, the guy's trying to talk to you, like, make a connection, and you're just like, oh, I haven't had anything to eat today.
Yeah, and then maybe you're, like, judging that, like, you are, like, can't stop looking at the food, and it maybe they're, like, there's, the thoughts could spiral so much. It could be like, okay, wait, should I take another? Like, are they noticing that I'm taking another? Or, like, wait, is now an appropriate time to take another? Or, like, you know, did I take too much? Do they want more? Like, it could really, you just get in your head so much when you struggle with your relationship with food that you're just, like, constantly running a monologue of like judgment and doubt about your food choices. A few fun questions now.
Okay.
As we wrap up.
All right.
Where are you right now in the hunger fullness scale?
Right now.
Right now. And like, give us a little assessment. So for background, I'll put the link in the show notes to download your own hunger fullness scale.
Oh my God. The people need to have that. If they don't have that, they need that. I have one personally on my bedroom wall.
He printed out the hunger fullness scale. It's on his wall. And this is a tool I use with my clients. This is a really common intuitive eating tool to help you drop into your body and figure out where you lie on the spectrum of hunger and fullness. And it's a scale of 1 to 10. 1 being, or 0 being like, tank is empty, absolutely like ravenous, primal hunger. 10 being so full, you feel regretful, you feel uncomfortable, you have to unbutton your pants and just lay down because it hurts.
I'm right at a 5 right now. Smack dab at pleasant. Neither full nor hungry.
Yeah.
We ate lunch like an hour and a half, 2 hours ago. I feel great. I feel good.
Yeah.
Sated.
Yeah. I would say I'm a 5 too. Maybe like a 4.5. I might be like slowly dropping.
You're going to need a snack in the next couple hours.
It depends when we get dinner.
Depends when we get dinner.
Yeah. Okay. I just want to say again, link in the show notes for the hunger fullness scale. It's a really helpful tool to.
Yeah. The people need that.
A lot of my clients will say like that's a turning point in their journey once they get their hands on the hunger fullness scale. So I offer it for free and you can download it via the link in the show notes.
Take advantage of that, guys. I mean, you know, this is gold.
This is gold. Okay. This next one. I don't know where you're gonna say this. What is your biggest diet culture pet peeve? Or one of your diet culture pet peeves?
I guess when people say like this is for eating at this time, that is for eating at another time, sort of like you can't put the cart before the horse. And I might like to have ice cream, you know, before dinner.
Mm-hmm.
And that's okay. You know, I can have whatever I want. So, you know, I don't want to be limited by somebody else as to the order or complexity of the food I can eat.
Mm-hmm. Arbitrary rules about like, this is breakfast, this is lunch, this is dinner, this is dessert,
mm-hmm.
that kind of thing.
That kind of thing.
What does intuition mean to you and how do you experience it?
What does intuition mean? Intuition means, for me, it's about the gut. Like, you don't need to think too hard. So really anything that involves thinking is moving away from intuition.
Mm-hmm.
So if I'm talking about what do I want to eat? I mean, this is a favorite of mine. You know, we like to joke about, I'll share with the class here. When we go to the grocery store, I like to shop with my eyes.
Mm-hmm.
When we go to eat or order something, I like to shop with my eyes. I don't want to think about it beforehand.
Mm-hmm.
You might ask me like, oh, what are you thinking you might want? And I might say, I'm not thinking about it. I just want to look at the menu and see what I like.
Yeah.
You know, so just trying to remove that element of logic. You know, that's kind of intuition to mm-hmm. me.
Just shopping with your eyes.
Shopping with my eyes. In that's life. What it means. In life, shop with your eyes.
Shop with your eyes in life. But I like that. I mean, you say that all the time. Like, I'll ask him, okay, what do you want at the grocery store? And he's like, I just want to go and shop with my eyes. Like, I don't want to make a list. I just want to go in there and feel what calls to me.
You know, and that's great. It's glorious. Sometimes let's get the record straight. You need to come to the store with a list.
Right.
Because I mean, that's one of the problems I have and why one of the reasons why I love spending time with you is you're a little more organized than I am. So, you know, we might have a plan for dinner, you know, which helps.
Yeah.
Because otherwise I might just go to the grocery store, buy a bunch of things, come back and realize I don't have like a concrete thing.
Because you shop with your eyes way too hard.
Yeah. I'm just like, oh, these pickles are great. Yeah. You know, but I love the look of that orange. I'm going to take that, you know.
The spirit of it, of shopping with your eyes, I think it's really interesting because you say that all the time and I never actually in my head thought like you're just using your intuition.
Mm-hmm.
But that is exactly what it is. So how do you experience intuition? Like when you're shopping with your eyes and you see something in your life and you're like, yeah, that's it. Like, how do you know that that's it?
Mm. You feel it. You feel it. You go and you imagine how it feels in your body when you look at it. It just hits. Like, I don't know how to explain it better than that. For those of us who maybe play a musical instrument, the comparison would be, you know, let's say you're hearing the background music and you're going to play your music along with it, inside of it, you just kind of hear the notes,
mm-hmm.
what you want to put on the page, rather. It just kind of like, it comes.
Yeah.
And I don't know, I mean, maybe food is slightly different than music, but, you know, how it would feel when I'm eating it. So like, if I'm in the store and I'm shopping with my eyes for a snack, and I see a juicy orange, I might imagine, say, like, the sweet, you know, flesh of the orange when I bite into it, and the juice that would maybe run down my chin as I take a huge, maybe too large bite.
Mm-hmm. And then you think, like, okay, that's how that would feel, and then, like, kind of putting that up against, like, is that what I want right now? And there's kind of, like, a ding, ding, mm-hmm. ding, yes, mm-hmm. if, like, that right. feeling matches what you're wanting.
Right. Like if my craving, and I might not understand what my craving is until I see it or feel it, but if my craving in truth is like a sweet, juicy experience,
mm-hmm.
like if I see a good looking orange, it'll be a bell that goes off like ding, ding. Wow. That looks delicious.
Mm-hmm.
If I see, you know, a nice looking group of bok choy, I might be like, okay, well, that looks good, but that's not it. There's no bell ringing, mm-hmm. you know, and that same bell might have rung for the orange, but also might have rung for a nice group of strawberries or a good watermelon. Mm-hmm. It's sweet. It's juicy.
Right.
You know, and that's what I'm craving.
So when I'm just diving deep with you on this question, because I like asking it to you. Intuition more broadly, like move out of the realm of food, when you have to make a decision mm-hmm. and you want to kind of like consult your gut mm-hmm. and you're like this or that, when you are trying to fill out what's the right thing, like how does the right thing feel versus how does the wrong thing feel in your body?
You know what comes to mind? The Marie Kondo TED Talk. Mm-hmm. Marie Kondo is like a minimalist kind of like organizational kind of
people probably
professional.
Know
people probably most people know probably know Marie Kondo, but for those of us who don't,
yeah,
she helps people kind of get rid of things in their
declutter,
yeah. you know. And one thing she says is like, keep the things that bring you joy.
Spark joy, yeah.
That spark joy.
Yeah.
And she has this demonstration on stage where she's describing what that means. Like, to find a thing that sparks joy, her body, like, opens up. Her hands go big in the air. Mm-hmm. Her face lights up. She looks to the sky.
Yeah.
You know? And she just kind of, it's like, ah. Mm-hmm. You know, that sort of feeling.
Expansive.
Expansive and groundbreaking and, you know, big and full of light.
Yeah. Lightness, expansive. And if it's the wrong decision, how does it feel?
And you kind of like, you close down, your hands go down, maybe across your chest, or, you know, your head goes down to the floor, sort of like a kind of closed feeling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful.
Definitely the people should check out Marie Kondo if they haven't heard of her, because that's...
You love her.
A great way to do your apartment, especially in New York, there's no space.
Yeah,
you shouldn't have
stuff. Only should have what sparks joy, definitely. Okay, is there anything else that we missed or anything else on your heart that you're wanting to share with the people while you're on mic?
I just want to share how great of an experience it is to be on the podcast. And anybody else might want to be on the podcast, I hope they have as good an experience as I did.
That's great. Anything else you want to say? Do you want to tell the people your feelings about butter? It's okay if you don't.
Well, so I know what Leah does for a living, and she helps people get right with some of the foods that scare them a little bit. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of times that could be like a fatty food that's been off limit for them.
Yes.
So, I mean, one of the classic examples of that is butter. I think it's great.
Loves butter, like in
like
a
butter.
Big way.
I put a lot of butter on my toast and anything else that I might put butter on, you know, like a sweet potato. So I would just say, you know, it's good for you. Like, you can't go wrong with butter. Too much is never too much.
He always says, butter, it's good for you. Like, it's one of his taglines. Like, I shop with my eyes. So
butter, comma, it's good for you.
Butter, comma, it's good for you.
Put that on a poster and slap it on your wall.
He's been begging to, like, be a guest speaker or something and on some form of my platforms to say that, to advocate for butter. So this, I wanted to really remind you that this is your chance.
This was my chance, and I almost missed it. And I'm so glad you reminded me.
I'm so glad I reminded you too. Well, thank you for being on the pod, Al. Really a special.
Thank you for having me.
For a while, it was like, when people asked for you, I was like, I don't know. It feels like it's more of them wanting to hear about my personal life and less relevant. But then I was like, you know what? These are good questions. And I think it can really be helpful for the people. So I really appreciate you coming to do this.
Thank you for having me. And, you know, it's okay if they want to hear about your personal life too. It's good to share that stuff sometimes.
Okay.
And I'm glad to be here.
If you enjoyed this episode, if it inspired you, if you learned something, it would mean so much to me if you rated it and reviewed it. And if you feel called to, share it with someone who it might resonate with. You can find me on Instagram at leahkern.rd. You can also join my weekly newsletter by visiting leahkernrd.com. And I'll see you next week.